Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is time for the podcast. I hope you're well. We've got a really fascinating little unique, unusual, and I think very, very global story for you today.
Yep.
And John, we're going to talk about the Irish-Italian community.
Yes, indeed.
Which is one of our oldest ethnic minorities, one of maybe the most integrated immigrants that we have in this country. And the reason I'm going to tell you, John, is I am just back from...
Will I see you hobbling there, Mark?
I'm telling you, hobbling. I'm telling you, all season...
Can you go on, tell us what happened.
Playing the full pitch, 11-a-side, against a bunch of silky Italians. And, of course, playing the middle of the park. Spraying balls around the place.
Mouthy Mac
vision,
in the middle
mouthy,
of the park.
You know, give and go all over the place. The linked man. No, but anyway... In my dreams. But no, so the football team, my football team...
De Bruyne,
exactly. Went over to a little part of Italy where the Irish-Italian community are from. And we stayed in a beautiful village called Casalvieri.
The whole Italian-Irish community are from...
Three villages. It's called the Valle del Camino. And around there...
Right, okay.
They're all from these places, right? So Marcellas, Fuscos, Borzas, Apriles... Fortes, all these people are from this area, right? And they all came in two different waves of immigration, which I'll talk about. And of course, there's a little bit of Joyce in here.
Because
Bloom befriended a man called Nannetti. And right. Nannetti was one of the original Italians who came over. And those guys came over in the 18th century. We'll talk about those in a second. But
okay.
Of course, Bloom liked Nannetti. And Nannetti was based on a real live character who became Ireland's first ethnic minority Lord Mayor. It was the Lord Mayor of Dublin called Joseph Patrick Nannetti, right? And Joseph
Wait,
Patrick Nannetti in 1907. And Nannetti is Ulysses. He's in Ulysses,
okay,
right?
Okay.
As a printer, okay, when Bloom was trying to get something.
And is that why Joyce went to Trieste?
I'm not sure, but he was definitely very much aware of the Italian-Irish community. And Bloom, of course, liked Nannetti because he could see that Nannetti was getting on as an immigrant. And Bloom was thinking to himself... Okay, I'm an immigrant too.
Yeah.
So if these Italians can get on, maybe I can get on too. So there was all that stuff going on.
Right.
But
you were playing football.
Of course I was playing football. I wasn't thinking about Joyce when I was playing football, but I actually was.
Maybe you were.
Yeah, I was.
The art of football.
The art of football. The fine art of football. But, so the area, just so you know. So Italy, a most amazing country. A country you know, I know you love. I love it. I think it's a fascinating place.
I love the food and the wine.
Well, there was a lot of that, believe it or not. But these villages are beside, just to give you a location, if people are trying to think where it was, you might remember there was a massive battle in the Second World War called Monte Cassino, which was the Germans, because of course the Italians changed sides in 1943. Yeah. And then the Germans freaked out and they put loads of German troops into Italy and they basically drew a line across the middle. And they said, we're going to keep the Americans, British, and I didn't know Poles. The Polish army fought enormously in this part of the world, right? So these villages where the Irish Italians are from are in and around that place.
Okay.
And Monte Cassino, which is known by a lot of people for the Second World War, was actually this extraordinary monastery of Saint Benedict. And it was established 1,000 years ago. That's the great thing about Italy. Everything's kind of ancient.
Yes.
1,000, you know, as a site of great scholarship and monastic endeavor and book writing and all sorts of things. And of course, it was bombed and razed to the ground by the Allies in 1944. And the Italians rebuilt it brick by brick, authentically, to exactly the same proportions as it had been. And it took them only 7 years. So then when you think about our children's hospital, they built this entire thing.
Don't even mention that.
I know. 7 years. But the village that we were in, Casalvieri, before we started. So we go into the bar, a bar.
Yeah.
And one of the lads is asking, slightly halting English, you know, could we have 2 glasses of wine and 2 beers and a cappuccino?
Yeah.
And your one says, I speak English. I'm from Kimmage. One behind the bar, right?
I'm from Kimmage.
Beside her was the chipper in Nutgrove, Mario Borza, who's running for Lord Mayor of the town.
Oh, Castle right.
Vieira, right?
Yeah.
And beside him again was the chipper from Bridgetown in County Wexford, the fellow who owned the takeaway. So it was bizarre. The first fellow we bumped into had a Des Kelly carpet shirt, right? Which is the pose he had. Some fella called Roberto. Right? It was just mad. Like, it was like
smack in the middle of Italy.
In the middle of Italy, there were all these...
In the boonies of Italy as well.
Right, really in the boonies. All these Dublin Italians who were all chatting away in Italian to each other. But the minute we saw them is, how are you? What's the story? You know, it was amazing. And
I know he's bored.
There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. And the guy who reffed the game was the chipper from Talla, right? That's what he does. He was just over visiting his cousins. And their manager... Of the Italian team.
Yeah. Oh, they have a manager.
Oh, well, of course, they're Italian. They have a manager.
That's a bit serious there.
And he was the chipper. He was also originally the chipper from Temple Oak. So it was just mad, right? And then, of course, we lost.
Yeah, go on. Tell us about the match.
Well, and
it was full 11 aside. Full pitch.
Full 11 aside. Big pitch.
Yeah.
Very warm. Very hot.
Right.
A lot of up and down the park, as one of our team was describing. We didn't have so much overlapping fullbacks as underlapping fullbacks. Right? And a lot of scratching our heads and saying, no, stalling the ball. But we went one up, then the Italians got one back.
Yeah.
Then they went 2-1 up and they did what the Italians always do, you know, catenaccio, which is park the bus, close up shop.
Right.
Which is, it's so funny. So it's in their DNA. It's in their footballing DNA.
And there was lots of diving, I'd say, as well.
Loads of diving.
Yeah.
Loads of referee and all this. But in actual fact, it was actually all played in very fine spirit, as you would expect from gentlemen of rather advanced ages.
Skormack.
No, Mr. Sinner.
That doesn't surprise me.
Exactly. Not even open goal. But the worst thing was, and I blasted and I thought it was going in.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh no, you turned.
No, I didn't turn. I didn't turn. The keeper got to it, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the game, you know, they told me he was 71.
Ah, Jesus, Mike.
So double humiliation, double shame. Anyway, it was a good trip. It was a very, very good trip. But what fascinated me, John, quite apart from discussing the football prowess of our lads, right? Which I think we can ignore now, right?
Move on swiftly.
Let's go to something.
Or not so swiftly.
But the interesting thing is, I want to put this story of the Irish Italians in the context of immigration, emigration, etc. People coming and going. There's push factors, there's pull factors. People come and make a life for themselves. And, you know, against the background of people talking about Ireland is full and we can't have any more immigrants, and immigrants are always and ever painted as dangerous, as threatening, or in some way these people are going to defile our women and these people, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
The real story of immigration is just humans trying to do their thing. And in fact, the whole story of humanity is the story of movement. Humans move. That's what we do, right? And this is why we look like we do, sound like we do, we speak the language we do, because we are constantly on the move. The history of humanity is the history of going from A to B. So just put this Italian story, which is interesting, I think it's quite genial, I think it's got a lot of beautiful anecdotes, but I want to put it in the context of economics, global economics, and the flow of people. So let's go to somebody who really understands these people. Deirdre Nuttall, who knows all about the Italian community, where they're from, how they got here. So let's go and talk to Deirdre. Now, from the playing fields of Lazio, we're going to actually get some detail as to who are the Irish, not Italians, because if you're a proper dub, you call them Italians, EYE Italians. Where do they come from? How do they all come from this village? And what their story is, because this is one of the most interesting ethnic minorities in Ireland, been around a long, long time. You don't need me to talk to you about it. I am going to talk to an ethnologist, somebody who really knows. Deirdre Nuttall, she's also married to an Italian. She's done a huge amount of work on the Irish-Italian community. She is on the line. Deirdre, how are you? Lovely to see you.
Yeah, likewise. How are you?
I'm flying. I'm in great form. Now, listen, I'm all fish and chips now, right? I'm all one-on-one. I'm all smoke, ray, and large, the whole thing. But I want to ask you, tell me about the Irish-Italian community. I think there's about 8 to 10,000 in the country, maybe a little bit more. Who are they? Where do they come from?
Yeah, the Irish-Italian community, I think, is probably the most well-established of our ethnic minorities. There were kind of two waves of Italians. There was an earlier wave that came in with the Georgian houses, and then later on with the big surge in the building of Catholic churches in the 19th century, and they were mosaic artists and plaster artists and so forth. But then from the late 19th century up until around the 1980s, there's this wave of people coming in from this small area between Rome and Naples.
The place I'm playing football here.
Yes, exactly. And it's fascinating because everyone comes from this small place. So the earlier people were coming over in the late 19th century. By the time of the 1911 census, a lot of the names that we know, like Borza and Macerdi and Fusco and so forth, a lot of those names are already in the census in 1911. But people kept coming after that. So it wasn't like just this one period of people coming. People were coming for generations because if someone needs a new employee or they wants to open a new shop, they would go back to the area that they came from and find a cousin or a brother. And for a certain amount of time in the earlier generations, people also went back to find spouses. So if someone wants to get married, in the earlier generations, people tried to marry still within that community. They're really a fascinating group of people. They've been, you know, extremely socially upwardly mobile, very hardworking. And I think the most exciting thing about them, like considering our more recent history of migration, is that they have both integrated and at the same time maintained a sense of their own ethnicity. So that's a really tricky balancing act, which yeah, they've been really, really good at.
And they've done that over a number of generations. But before we talk about the people themselves, let's talk about the area. So we are in central Italy. We are south of Rome, very hilly, very provincial. Do you know why Ireland? Because if you look at Italian history, Italian immigrant history, so, you know, when we're thinking of like Italian Americans, we're talking about people who came during the same period. They left Italy in the 1880s, 1890s. A huge amount of them ended up in New York, an enormous amount of them ended up in Argentina. But this little tiny section ended up in Ireland. And do we know why?
No, and it's fascinating. I mean, they arrived at a time of mass emigration from Ireland.
Yes.
So Irish people were also flocking to New York and flocking to London, flocking to Australia. And these people came to Ireland and they found a niche and they filled it. So what's interesting is that they didn't come straight to Ireland in many cases. So a lot of families would originally have left and they would have maybe worked their way up through Italy, through Northern Italy, which is more prosperous than the area where they came from. And then they might have worked in France for a while and then they made their way to England, to Britain. But the families in Ireland, many of them didn't come straight to Ireland. Many of them actually came via Glasgow.
Yes.
So they had literally kind of worked their way on foot and public transport and whatever through Britain, picking up, you know, different habits as they went. And then a lot of them came through Glasgow into Northern Ireland initially and then filtered down. So while there were already people here in the Republic of Ireland from the late 19th century, those numbers increased quite a lot from the 1930s upwards. I mean, I guess partly people were looking for opportunity, but also Italy was obviously in a difficult situation during the war. And the area that they came from was extremely badly affected by the war. So there was a push for more people to come. And then during the Second World War, Italian citizens in Britain could be interned because they were technically
Axis members, members of the Axis. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so a lot of them were actually interned, I think it was Jersey or Guernsey. And so some people would have kind of hopped over to Ireland at that stage because, you know, they already had relatives over here running fish and chip shops and ice cream shops and cafes and stuff. A lot of them were working in the food industry. So there was another big surge of people then, like from the 30s and 40s onwards, escaping what was going on in Italy at that time. And the area that they're from, it was near some extremely active fighting during the Second World War. You know, there was a kind of almost a famine situation. First, there was violence from the Allies, and then there were reprisals by the Germans. So the area was extremely badly affected during the war. So even the kind of grimness of Ireland in the 40s and 50s might have looked
like paradise.
More attractive. Yeah.
Okay, so the big interest, like when we go to Italy, we have caprese salad, burrata. We have spaghetti of all sorts. We have pasta. We have extraordinary food. We don't have fish and chips. You do not go to Italy. So explain to me the association between Italians and chippers.
Yeah. So far as I know, the first fish and chip shops that opened up in southern England in places like Brighton, and it was something you could do with not speaking English very well. So you didn't really have to deal with complicated orders. You know, it was tasty. It was immediately very popular because fish and chips are delicious. So a lot of people actually started with ice cream and they kind of segued into fish and chips. So fish and chips isn't necessarily the first one, but fish and chips caught on very quickly. People loved it as soon as it was introduced. And then, you know, you could have your cousin or your brother come over and he could be immediately making fish and chips without having to speak English terribly well. So it was a good in to the food industry.
And so the Great Dublin, the one-on-one, comes from that, doesn't it? They just had one of them
Yeah, I believe there was a chipper near Trinity College in the 1890s. And according to legend and lore, that is where the phrase come from. It's actually been traced back to the lady who worked in that shop. Who didn't speak. Yeah, she didn't speak English, but she learned how to say one of this, one of that. And that's apparently where the phrase comes from.
Just so non-Dubliners who are listening to this will know, the one-on-one is the great, the fish and chips, you know, cotton chips, and it's just a one-on-one. Yeah. And that's where it comes from. Actually, I heard a great thing about the rations of petrol. Deirdre, tell us that story. It's a fascinating story about access to petrol in the Second World War. Tell us that one again.
Yeah, allegedly, during the Second World War, fuel was very strictly rationed. So I think it was like government ministers, doctors, some state engineers. So very, very restricted numbers of people had access to fuel during the Second World War. And apparently the chippers did have access to fuel during the Second War because they were by then an important source of calories for particularly working class communities.
No, absolutely. No, it shows that De Valera was very clever. He was. Fianna Fáil never miss a trick. This is the whole thing, right? You've got petrol for, you know, the cops and the fire brigade and the army and the chippers.
Yeah.
And again, what is fascinating is the way in which the Italians colonized estates, like the big estates in Ireland as they were built. This really interests me. Explain that to me.
Yeah, no, these were very, very clever, very astute business people. So what was happening, there were the big waves, as you know, big waves of building in independent Ireland. So you had places like Crumlin being built, and then a bit later, places like Sallynagan being built. Every time a new estate was built or every time a town had a new suburb, a chipper would go in really quickly. It would often be like the first business.
Yeah.
Before the pub even, before the church.
Before the Catholic church, yeah.
So they were very, very good at doing that. So they'd be like, oh, look, there's a new housing estate. You know, it's going to be, you know, 5,000 people living there. Chipper would go in and, you know, the cousin would be brought over from that same area to run it. And people expanded their businesses like that. And you know, I have to say they were an extremely hardworking people. People are talking about working 18-hour days, these immensely long days. Kids coming home from school and, you know, putting on the apron and putting in an hour or two chopping potatoes before doing their homework.
Yeah, John, you remember the Marcellus who lived around our...
Absolutely. Well, they were in school with us too.
Yeah, and they'd go back from school and then straight into the chipper in Monkstown Farm. Into the chipper. You know, and they would work 10 hours after school.
Absolutely, yeah.
And tell me about, dear, any of the small idiosyncratic sort of footprints that the Italians have left in urban Ireland in particular.
Well, I have this theory. I haven't proven it, but one of the things that made it easier for the Italians to settle in was their Catholic faith. And so, especially in the earlier fish and chip shops, they were absolutely festooned with holy pictures. And of course, the Irish also loved holy pictures. So this was a kind of a cultural thing that people had in common. And the name Goretti for a girl's name in inner city Dublin is a thing. Goretti is a surname in Italian. And there is a very popular saint called Maria Goretti. And I think possibly that name entered the Irish lexicon through the Italians. I haven't proven it yet, but I have that belief. And obviously they also influenced Irish foodways in other ways, because they weren't eating fish and chips the whole time at home. They were eating, you know, pasta, and they were eating other staples of Italian cuisine. And Irish people who were friendly with them would have gotten to know those kind of dishes through them. So they had a big influence on the foodways in that respect. I mean, a number of people also have commented to me that they've been this example of how to do migration right. You know, how to succeed, how to assimilate, how to keep your own culture. And now a lot of them, now they're seeing with their employees that their employees might be from Romania or countries, and they're now on a similar journey, you know, a few generations later on, and there are very close parallels between what they're going through and what the current generation of Italian Irish know from their parents and grandparents' stories, that they're having a very similar, you know, experience.
Well, I'll tell you what, I am now going to go back to my glass of Valpolicelli. But Deirdre, that was fantastic. Thank you so much. And you also have a book about the ethnology of Dunleary coming out.
Yeah, Dunleary wrapped down. So it's the whole county, not just the Dunleary. Yes, it's coming out in June. So would be great to talk to you about that later.
But we would absolutely love to have you on.
Very exciting.
A niche market, yes, but very important market.
Very important.
Great stuff. Well, listen, Deirdre, it's wonderful to talk to you. And we'll chat to you again, hopefully in a couple of weeks' time, about Dunleary.
Okay, super. Take care.
So that was Deirdre Nuttall to give us the context and the bird's eye view of the Italian-Irish and how
Italians, please.
The Italians and how they arrived here. Actually, you said it in that, and I thought it was really interesting, is the fact that when you are in Italy, you don't eat fish and chips. You're eating the pizzas and pastas
and all that
kind of stuff.
And all the rest of the
And all
stuff.
The rest. And they came here and they made fish and chips.
Because migrants adapt.
Yeah.
This is the interesting thing. Yeah, immigrants think, okay, how can I make a crust here? What do these people do? They make fish and chips. They eat fish and chips. We'll make it for them.
Yeah.
And we will work 24/7 to do that. And that's the thing. You never saw a chipper closed.
Yeah.
You never saw a chipper closed, right?
It was actually a treat in our house.
Oh, yeah, to go to the chipper. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but they were never closed.
Yeah.
They were always open.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was Deirdre giving us the sort of the big picture. Why don't we talk to one of the community themselves, see what it was like growing up here as an Irish Italian. So let's go talk to Pace Borza, see what it's like being an Irish Italian. So we have one of the Italians on the line. We have Pace Borza Butterly. Pace, how are you? Lovely to see you.
I'm very good, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Not at all. Look, Pace, this is one of the great Dublin stories, Irish stories. Tell me about your family.
So my Borza family are from Mandatico, but like there's loads of, like, within the Val di Camino region, there's other villages like Casalattico and Monteforte, which is Mortal originally, but it was called Monforte because that's where the Fortes came from.
The Rocco Fortes of the...
The Rocco Fortes, the art dealers, the hoteliers, the mega wealthy Fortes, they originally came.
No way, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Mandatico is Mountain of Atticus. So Titus Pompus Atticus, he would have been a Roman banker who was friends with Cicero. And legend has it that he had a villa up in Mandatico, which is where my ancestry are from. So that is at the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, really. It's fairly remote, about an hour and a half inland from Rome, up in this beautiful mountainous region. And it's where all the Irish Italians largely came from.
So tell me, how did your mum get here? How did your granny get here on your mum's side?
Nonna Pace, she actually was essentially raised in Belfast.
Okay.
So her father, Giuseppe Borza, he would have moved to Scotland in the 20s, I think. And he set up ice cream parlours. And from Scotland, he moved across to Belfast because of the shipbuilding and the industry. And there was a huge working class population that needed to be fed. And he kind of migrated between ice cream and fish and chips. And he then brought over his family. So Angela and Donia, his wife, and his two daughters, Pace and Ida, who would have been about 8 at the time. So that was in the 30s. My Nonna Pace, I never had the pleasure to meet her, but I knew Ida very, very well. She actually only passed away about 10 years ago. And she spoke with the thickest Belfast accent you ever did hear. And she lived at the top of a mountain in the most remote part of Italy. So it was a real like,
wow. You know.
So Pace grew up in Belfast and she would go back to the village, the ancestral village in Mandatico for her holidays. And in the 40s and 50s, she, you know, she would have been back and forth after the war and stuff. Whereas my nonno, he was there in Italy during the war. And basically where the Val di Camino sits is along the Gustav line. So it was very much, you know, the frontier of the war.
Between the Germans and the Americans.
Yeah. And a lot of the men would have been rounded up during the war. And it was funny because the men, the Italian men were being rounded up in Italy by the Germans, and back in Belfast, the Italian men were being rounded up by the British.
Yes, exactly. So, so you were screwed both ways.
Couldn't win.
Yeah.
So basically, after the war, my granny obviously went back to the village at some stage and met this handsome goat farmer who was my nonno Achille. And together they returned to Belfast and they started their family. So my aunt and uncle were born in Belfast. And when they were young, quite young, my nonno, Chile, couldn't stay in Belfast because he was Italian. And the British, they didn't want the Germans and the Italians. Basically, he couldn't stay. So, but my nonna Pace had a British passport because she'd been living there since she was 8. So they came south. They came to Dublin and they set up. They were at this stage, they were in fish and ship business.
Yeah.
And they set up a shop.
The business. Exactly.
They were actually, my nonna Pace, her father, Giuseppe Borza, was various, he would have been quite established at this stage up in Belfast. And he had shops on the Omer Road up in Belfast. And he would have been very much a facilitator of other families coming over. He would have acted essentially like a bank because people wouldn't have had, the connections to get loans to get,
This is fascinating. So the community lent to each other.
They lent to each other very much. The people who came first brought the others to work in the shops. And as I said, first the men came and then the families came. And then after the war, of course, there was huge migration out of Italy.
Yeah.
Not just to Ireland, but like across the world. But the more and more came, people who had family in Ireland and in Belfast, in my case, came and they migrated south. So my grandparents set up a shop on Dorset Street, I think it was 55 Dorset Street. It's now known as the Midnight Express. You might drive by it the odd time on the way to the airport. So that's where my dad, Antonio, grew up with his brothers and his sister.
But, you know, it's an amazing story because what it is it's emigration, it's resilience, it's community, it's adaptation. In a way, I suppose, Pace, if you're to look at it, it's kind of what all immigrants do. And sometimes, you know, now when you've got all this Ireland is full stuff and, you know, who are these people, etc., you don't realise that all immigrants emigrate in the same way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they they leave for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, there would have been people who left for war reasons from Italy, but there were also largely economic migrants. You know, my people would have been from this remote, tiny village at the top of a mountain. There was no economy. You know, there was a couple of goats and very little education, really. And they just had to make do with the opportunities that they had. And they were hard workers, you know, and it wasn't easy for, you know, my grandparents' generation.
No.
Even then, there was a lot of, you know, behind the counter at 3 a.m. in the morning on Dorset Street. I can tell you it wasn't
exactly
particularly polite.
Fort Apache. just before you go, Apache, because I love this sort of human story, but what really is fascinates me about the Italians. You're saying they came from a very remote area, you know, mm-hmm. during the Second World War. It was not an easy to be Italian on either side. Not much education. And yet, when these Italians arrived in Ireland, they made an amazing fist of it, economically, socially. My point is, what do you think was going on that made these people so commercially savvy and successful? And hardworking, you know. So within a generation or two, the Italians were very much an established community.
Yeah. Well, I think survival was a big thing, I'll be honest. You know, they're tough people. They're mountain people.
Yeah.
Like I said, they come from a very tough life, tough world. Like, you know, only the tough survived, really. And they migrated, like I said, after the war, more and more people came and people were hiring relations. So they weren't settling for somebody who wasn't going to work hard. You know, it was a tough job. Like, and I think that that's how certainly the work ethic, that's where the work ethic comes from, you know, and money. They love money. I mean, that's a real poison thing. They love money. I don't know where it comes from, but yeah.
I love it. I love it. Listen, Fatima, we'll leave it there, but it's a lovely picture.
No worries.
It's a lovely picture that you paint of a family of over a lot of generations through lots of adversity, basically experiencing Ireland like almost... it's a unique experience living in Belfast, coming down, all that stuff going on, and then just settling in and then becoming the Irish Italians, you know?
Yeah, the history is just, it's like in stone. When I went up to Belfast there last year with the kids, we went to Milltown Cemetery, and right beside the Republican plot, there are my great granny and granddad.
No Fair way.
Oh,
brilliant.
Nice.
Lovely way to end this. That's a lovely way to end it. Patrick, we will talk to you again. See
ya. Okay, Grace. Bye. Bye.
John, that was Patrick Borza. We're going to now go talk to another Borza, Camillo Borza.
Another Italian.
Italian, who organised the football trip. The problem is, he actually saw the football match.
Yes, I know. I have some questions for him.
So you have the sanitised David McWilliams version of his own performance and the actual real. So let's go. He's actually, Camillo's still in the village now. We left yesterday. He's still there. So let's go down to the middle of nowhere, between Rome and Naples, as Patchy described it, up the top of the village, up the top of a mountain, and talk to Camillo Borza. Camillo, how are you? You're still there. Are you missing us already?
Dave, I still haven't recovered from the match. I'm just so disappointed. I mean, I never expected to lose. I don't like losing. You know, it was a tough one to take. But we had a blast. We had a blast.
Before we go any further, Camillo, can you just describe Macker's sitter?
Are you talking about the first one or the second one?
Oh!
Listen, the key about football is showing. You got to show for these things. But yeah, the first one, the second one. Yeah, it's like, if it had been the third, it was like, okay, fuck it, I'm going home.
How bad was
it? How bad was it? I mean, do you ever watch Sky Sports News? Saturday afternoon, live football. They're going like this. Oh, my God, I can't believe he's missed. And the one person in the crowd that was actually watching the match, I could see them react the exact same way. Hands in the head like this going, oh, my God, what has he just missed?
Incredible stuff. It was that bad.
Couldn't make it up, Jim.
And it was
great game, great day.
And great weekend.
We only lost 2-1.
Yeah, exactly. Against a crack Italian outfit who were playing bangers.
70-year-olds,
You know, but there was a 70-year-old keeper, but there was at least two or three 30-year-olds on their side.
Sure, right.
Anyway, Camillo, we've just done this tour around the community, the impact of the Italian-Irish in Ireland, the commercial savvy, the hard work, the nous, the grit, all that sort of stuff. You know, when you look at the community now, I mean, what do you think the future is going to be for this community? Because it's very much part of the Dublin or the Irish background noise.
It's hard to know where the future lies. We are very lucky with the advent of low cost flights and all that we can keep in touch with the village. You know, you can book a flight the next day. You can be over there for a weekend. The landscape has changed. I mean, technically speaking, you know, when a group of people settle in a country, you know, that's the word, settle. They're meant to stay there. They're meant to become part of that community after X number of generations. But I suppose we're a bit different because we're all from this one tiny little village. It's accessible nowadays. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, you might go back for a month, 2 months. You'd stay a while because we didn't have Ryanair, right? So it's kind of changed. I suppose it's a positive thing for our community. But, you know, you would expect eventually the thing to kind of dissipate a bit. Hopefully not.
Well, it was funny. I mean, just telling John, we walked into that bar. The girl from behind the bar was from Kimmage. Your cousin is actually running for mayor, for Lord Mayor of the village. And he's originally from Churchtown, is he? And
Mario Borza, yeah.
So there is, I mean, the connection's very, very strong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we came straight from Fiumicino. We arrived at the restaurant there in Casalantico. And the first thing we saw was a Bose top, right? I mean, you wouldn't expect to see a Bose jersey outside a restaurant in the middle of nowhere in Italy, right?
You wouldn't expect to see a Bose jersey in Dalkey, let alone.
It was quite a moment, you know.
Yeah, no, it was.
Especially with an ex-Bose player in our group,
yeah,
in our midst.
We do have an ex-Bose player. We actually do, John. Or, have a fella who actually played, a guy called Dave Tilson, who actually played proper football. Now, God love him. He's to carry all these Egypts around. And he's a man of immense patience, I suspect. That's what we describe him.
The Liam Brady of the team.
Yes, exactly. Liam Brady squared of the team. But Camillo, listen, I know you're going to dinner back there. I'll see you next week on the park. But listen, thanks very, very much. And listen, I've had the crack for the next few days.
Cheers, Dave. Thanks, Emil.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Oh, like that trip sounded like the crack.
Oh, it was a great crack. It was really, really good fun. Really good fun.
But in all of that, though, there is a serious point in all this, isn't there?
There is.
And especially in the current kind of climate of everyone roaring and shouting about immigration, which is fair enough. But, you know, I mean, you and I were immigrants from here, and we went to London. And the one thing that struck me, and Patche was talking about the work ethic, and I think there's an immigrant work ethic.
Yeah,
you know, if you get up off your arse and make the effort to go somewhere, you're not going there to sit in your arse.
Well, that's actually true. You know what I think, and this is the bigger point, is that migrating, moving from A to B is a transformational act. And by that I mean it's a personal act of individual transformation. What you say to yourself, I am bigger than this place. I want to see something bigger than my village. Even if it's somebody from the country come to Dublin or whatever it happens to be, right? That moment of migration is a sort of a defiant act in your own head that you're going to make something more of your life than you perceive to be the constraints from where you're from. So there's a natural selection within immigrants, okay? A certain type of person goes. That's the first thing. Now, the second thing is that because you have no networks, it's impossible to arrive in a country and just sit back, right? You have to go out and work.
Yeah.
And the third thing, though, is that immigration is about capacity, because economists talk about immigration, but actually what you get is humans. And humans need housing, they need infrastructure, they need all sorts of stuff. So if we are going to open ourselves up to more and more immigrants in Ireland, the quid pro quo of that is that's what we want to do, is we need to build much, much more. And then there's a lot of people saying, well, hold on a second, it's a capacity issue. So should we be saying it's 30,000 per year or 40,000 per year? You know, because what you want to do is you want to keep the idea that the immigrant story of the Italian Irish becomes the origin story of other people. Mm. They arrive here, they're poor, they work hard, they have the resourcefulness of their own community, like you heard about the Italians lending to each other and all that sort of stuff, right? And eventually you just slot in and you thrive. And in their case, they're very lucky, as Camilla says, they can actually go back and forth over two or three generations, which is amazing. And as I said, there's so much evidence from there. That might not necessarily be the same for everybody.
What Deirdre said as well is that the Italian story, the Italian-Irish story, is kind of the framework of how to do immigration.
Yes, and there's a huge amount of fondness towards the Italians because they fed us. Right? See, so it's different. But I mean, the Polish-Irish story will be the same. The Brazilian-Irish story will be the same. You know, the Moldovan-Irish story will be the same. And eventually the Nigerian-Irish story will be very similar, right? Mm. That's what actually happens. So at a time when everyone is talking about Ireland as full, not just Ireland, at a time when everyone is going right-wing, from France to Britain to Italy itself to Germany, and pointing the finger at people who don't look like us.
Mm.
And I can understand that. I can understand that. But what we've got to realize is you put the mirror up to yourselves. We're all migrants. Everyone is a migrant. Everyone came from somewhere. Very, very few of us have got this God-given right to only be here exclusively. And migration, whether we like it or not, there's 8 billion people on this planet.
Yeah.
Okay. There's massive social, economic, and opportunity disparity between the third world or the global south and us. And people are going to come. And we've just got to figure out how to deal with it. And I think the Italian-Irish story is one way of dealing with it, an incredibly successful one, an uplifting one, a joyous one, and one that's a bit of fun. So maybe that's the template. Forza Italia. We'll talk to you next week.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.